You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Think about how many impossible conversations you've had with people, even your friends, over the past year. Like, oh, don't you understand the facts? Oh, this is fake news. No, it's not. These are the facts. No, they're not. You believe this, how could you? You must be an evil, bad person. Or you believe in this, you must be some kind of lunatic or idiot or whatever. Think of all the friends lost, family lost, impossible conversations you've had. How to Have Impossible Conversations, a book by my next guest, Peter Boghossian. Fascinating topic, and I learned a huge amount. And the first thing I learned was facts don't matter. How true that is, but let's hear the rest. How to Have Impossible Conversations. You ever have one of those conversations? Like I have this with my kids all the time. They'll come in and say something like, I don't know, like rioting is okay in a protest because Martin Luther King said rioting is the voice of the unheard, which is taken completely out of context, but it's impossible to explain that. So, and I don't even know how to have, but I've learned through my children and through social media, thankfully or unthankfully, how to have impossible conversations. Today, I have with me Peter Boghossian, who along with James Lindsay wrote a book, How to Have Impossible Conversations, a very practical guide. And Peter, I think you were referring to these types of conversations from what I'm reading in the book.
Correct, correct. Thanks for having me on, James.
So I love this book because this is so important in today's society. We all have been having impossible conversations, and for bad and good, like you have a conversation about some really politically hot topic and you know you're not going to get anywhere. It's not like anyone has ever said, thank you for changing my mind. Like that has happened never. And one of the things you say in this book, and we'll get into some of the techniques because I've folded over like half the pages in this book. But One thing that you've said in this book, and I've already quoted you in conversation, is that don't use facts.
Correct.
And that's, and it, I almost thought that was funny. Like I laughed, I LOL'd at that, but it's really serious and you're really right. And I mentioned it to a few people and they're like, yeah, that's totally true. You can't use facts. So maybe give an example of a conversation where you've tried to use facts and it didn't work out. Because I notice in this book, you're the bad guy in many of these conversations.
Right. So let me talk before I do that. Let me just speak to why you don't want to use facts. So there's something called the backfire effect. And when one uses facts, they hunker down in their beliefs even more so.
Right. So if you say, for instance, if someone's pro-life and another person's pro-choice and the pro-life person says it's murder and the pro-choice person says, no, it's not. There's no evidence that there's a human being alive there, and the pro-choice, pro-life person will, using facts, will just kind of strengthen the pro-life person's.
Right. So that's already the mistake right there. So they've delivered a message, they've used facts. If using facts changed people's minds, then everyone would believe the same thing according to the facts.
Yeah, that's a really good point. By the way, I just want to mention the pro-life, pro-choice example is just an example. My business partner for 20 years is pro-life. I'm pro-choice. We've never once had an argument because, Peter, we've used many of the techniques kind of maybe instinctively in this book.
Yeah, great. And so I think it's important to remember, I don't know if you saw the Bill Nye Ken Ham debate.
No.
Okay. Well, Bill Nye is Bill Nye, the science guy, and Ken Ham is a creationist. And they were talking about the arc and evolution. And at the end of the debate, they were asked, what would change your mind? And Ken Ham said, nothing would change my mind.
Which is honest, by the way.
Oh, yeah, which is honest. The more emotional valence or moral valence an idea has, the more important it is to not use evidence. So if you don't care about something one iota, like the diameter of a hamburger bun in comparison to Burgerville. We have Burgervilles here, that's like a humane McDonald's analog. If you don't care about that, then you can present facts. But as a general rule, those aren't impossible conversations. In fact, those aren't even difficult conversations. Never want to present facts or evidence.
Right. And I like how you take this sort of, you refer to Socrates quite a bit. You take the Socratic view that ask them questions, let them come up with kind of the reasoning one way or the other of their thinking.
Because you're basically asking someone if they agree with themselves. And most people, I know this is a weird way to think about it, but they simply don't agree with themselves. I've been doing this for well over a quarter century now. I did my dissertation in prisons. I've worked with religious hardliners. I've gone up. And we are not taught how to ask targeted questions about what people believe and expose the methods of knowing. And so usually conversations, people deliver messages. And I'm advocating a completely different way to conceptualize a conversation, broadly based on the historical Socrates, the way he talked.
I know there's the bias that the backfire effect, that if you present facts, people are going to be more defensive. But if they're actual facts, why don't they acknowledge, like if so-and-so politician says X, and you say, well, politician said X, and then the response I often get is, no, they didn't. And I'm like, here it is. He says it. No, that's wrong. That's just the media reporting.
Right.
And so why is it that people don't, and by the way, I'm not talking any political bias. I just want to qualify that. But on either side, nobody believes facts. Like if it's a fact, why don't they believe it?
Right. Well, because we bend facts to narratives. So people don't formulate their beliefs on the basis of evidence. They're storytelling. We like stories. Our brains are not hardwired for double blind peer review. They're simply not. They're hardwired for narratives. They're hardwired for social relationships. They're hardwired for communities. Excuse me. That's the other thing that it's important to understand is when you're talking about someone's beliefs, you're only ostensibly talking about their beliefs. What you're really talking about is their moral community. And you're talking about their sense of belonging. And you're talking about the sense of relationships they have.
So you're saying, let's take the top five strong beliefs that people have. Let's say whether it's for president or climate change or abortion or gun control or
trans bathrooms,
you know, so there's all these issues that have been, you know, Israel-Palestine. There's all these issues that have been in the media, obviously, or masks, no masks. You know, there's all been these issues. By the way, and it's odd that all these issues are oddly correlated, even though they have nothing to do with each other, that 75 million people believe all of the same uncorrelated issues, and the other 75 million people believe all of the other uncorrelated issues the opposite way.
That's an evolutionary mechanism. And so we've more or less divided into tribes, and the fault lines in this culture war are pretty clear. But I interrupted. Please continue.
That's the question. You're saying we basically get our strong beliefs from these huge amorphous tribes. You know, like a tribe historically has 30 people in it. Now you're saying a tribe could have 75 million people in it, or however big. So you're saying, why have we in some ways devolved as opposed to evolved into having the same beliefs automatically as 75 million other people?
Well, it's a really interesting question. Part of it has to do with social media. Part of it has to do with memetic warfare, which memes have won out. We don't really think in terms of the evolution of ideas, but ideas have a very specific evolution and trajectory and sticking point. And so the question is, for me, it's less the genesis of how did this happen, although that's a cool thought. People, I just read Neil Ferguson's book. He's talked a little bit about this, about how we deal with doom and pandemics, et cetera. But it's less that, and it's more, how do we navigate this reality in the world, given that people hold their beliefs so tenaciously and they're not willing to change? How do we get along as a society? You know, and let me give you another something I've been thinking about. So can I put you on the spot?
Yeah.
In 2019, how many unarmed black men were killed by police?
Like the exact number?
Yeah, well, to throw out, just give me your best guess. Don't Google it.
Okay, I'm not Googling. I'm gonna do a legit guess. How many unarmed black men were killed by police? I'm gonna go with less than 20.
Wow, that's really good. So to me, that tells me you're living in reality. I asked one of my neighbors that. She told me 22,500.
Well, there's the issue is there's 40 million African Americans, black people in the country, and so if you work off that number, the number's too high. Every day in the news we would be hearing about this, and we didn't in 2019.
Yeah, well, so that's a really good example of if people have incorrect information coming out. Coming into them, then the output for that information, their actions would be like, this is an outrage. We need to, you know, I live in Portland. I see everywhere spray painted ACAB. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Good. It means you must live in some place that's civilized. All cops are bastards. It's spray painted on walls. It's on concrete. And the consequence, if somebody has an incorrect piece of information, that's why when people would say to me when I was in the New Atheist movement, well, why do you care so much about this? Like, why is this such a big deal? And it's such a big deal because if someone's starting information is incorrect, that will cause them to create a reality around themselves and to make circumstances in their community in which they think will lead to their flourishing, but will not. Right? So the question is, how do we navigate that in terms of a conversation with people, given that we cannot introduce facts to them? Because look, this is a great example. You asked me for an example. Let's say that as my neighbor did, 22,500 unarmed, which is a very specific number, by the way, unarmed black men were killed by police in 2019. If I say, you know, no, that's just not true. Here's the evidence. She would say, well, there's a cover up, the body cams didn't catch it all, or the court systems adjudicate in the favor of police. I mean, there'd be any one of a number of defense mechanisms to keep the belief in place. So there's a vested interest to not dislodge the belief. So instead of providing evidence, which is almost always, if not always, a mistake, the best way to do it is to ask people very gently how they came to that conclusion. Oh, that's really interesting. How did you come to that number? Where'd you get that figure?
Yeah.
And then, right.
What did your neighbor say?
Well, I didn't ask that. I asked another question that we haven't talked about. This is, once you get a even basic facility with this, this will rocket your conversations to a whole new level. And it's in the book. It's scales. You ask people to put their belief on a scale. So I said, oh, that's really interesting. On a scale from 1 to 10, how confident are you in that? With 1 being, I plucked it out of the freaking air, 5 being maybe, 7 being I'm pretty sure, 10 being I'm absolutely confident. I'm completely certain that that number is. She said to me 7.
Okay.
So once you get that number of 7, actually, I think she said 7.1, but once you get that number, whatever the number is, that will tell you or inform you about the next set of questions you should ask, which is, so people have well-rehearsed responses and defense mechanisms for their conclusions, but they have virtually nothing for their epistemologies. In other words, for how they came to knowledge. And so by simply asking a few probing questions, you can get them to ask themselves if that number 22,500 makes any sense.
Yeah. So after she said 7.1, what did you say to her? Or what would you say to her?
I said, oh, that's so every time you do that, you always have to reaffirm somebody's position. Oh, that's really interesting. Oh, that's cool. How do you know that? It's Socrates' question. It's the most basic question. It's the simplest question in the world. I'm sure it predates Socrates' life, but Socrates, who's certainly the popularizer of that question,
he became famous asking how do you know that? That's his key, you know, his pathway to fame.
Yeah, and they killed him for it.
He invented the question. Yeah,
they killed him for it too. Fortunately, we have other techniques that we can add to prevent you from being killed. So it's not just the Socratic method. It's based upon a suite of techniques from cutting edge literature. But I would say it's really interesting. And then she started talking about the media, and I just drilled down on those claims. Well, where you know what? I'm just curious. The other thing you can do with scales. So I want to make sure in this conversation that people walk away from this having things they can use. So the moment they walk into a conversation, boom, they're good to go. So here's something you can say. So somebody says something that either you find bizarre, which increasingly happens to me, or I was drinking last night and with some friends. Everybody's happy that the society is opening up again. And somebody came up to us and said, if they wanted to play a drinking game, which was hipsters or homeless. And when people walk by in the street, we would guess if they were hipsters or homeless.
Oh, that's
and
a good
just,
one.
I just, that really cracked me up. But anyway, sorry, getting back to it. So people will have well-rehearsed defense mechanisms for their conclusions, but not for the processes that they came to for those conclusions. So what almost invariably will happen is they'll overestimate their confidence based upon the evidence that they have, right? So,
but what do you do if she says, okay, well, I got this from XYZ News, you know, and she names some famous newspaper, and yeah, she says they're always reliable as opposed to ABC News, which is never reliable.
Well, that's a great question. So then you can ask a bunch of other questions. So you could say, she didn't say that, but here's an example of if she said that, say, oh, well, that's really interesting. Can you think of anyone on the other side who would have a different figure, and why would someone come to that? Here's another thing you could do with scales. That's really interesting because I'm at a 2 confidence on that, on the 1 to 10 scale. And I'm wondering if you can help me get to 10 or excuse me, 7.1. Like, what am I missing that would get me there? And then she'll just spell it out. Well, this is it. So she gives you a guided tour of her epistemology or her methods for knowledge.
But she could be so confident at every level. She could say, well, you probably listen to, you know, blah, blah, blah news, which is, you know, I know a lot of people listen to it, but it's all lies.
Yeah. Okay. So right there. So that's why it's really important that you don't make a claim in these conversations. So you don't make any claim. So if you want to make a claim, always put it on a scale.
Okay.
So when she says to you, oh, well, you probably listen to blah, blah, blah. Well, first of all, almost no one's going to say that to you unless you've tipped your hand or shown your cards about what you believe. But if you don't do that, there's no way she can know what you believe. And you'll see the other thing that's really fascinating, having literally done this with tens of thousands of, I mean, I don't even know how many people at this point. I don't think I've ever seen a single person in the unbelievable number of times I've done this become defensive when I've asked them questions about the method they came to knowing.
You,
Nobody.
You,
hardcore Muslims. I mean, nobody, literally nobody.
When you use scales.
Well, no, in fact, quite the contrary. Not only do they not become defensive, they want to tell you about how they know. They're excited to tell you about their beliefs. People love to talk about their beliefs because they want you to believe what they believe.
Right. But what if they kind of, so you're saying there's no, if you say you're a 2.1 on the scale or a 2 on the scale.
Yeah.
Won't they believe, I would instinctively believe that you are against me because I'm 7 and you're 2. So that's why I would say, make the assumption that you listen to like the wrong news.
Yeah, that would be a faulty, that would be, so here's what I would say. So if someone said, well, you know, you must listen to X news, that's actually the good thing about, I don't really almost listen to any news at this point. I've wiped it all out.
No, me neither.
Yeah, I would just say, no, I'm just someone who's genuinely curious, which is the, you always want to be truthful in these conversations too. So I am genuinely curious about how people come to knowledge. So I would say that. The other thing is people have a pretty good bullshit detector. Oh, I should have asked if I could swear on your show, but.
Oh yeah, you can.
Okay, so people have a pretty good bullshit detector. And so if you're going to bullshit someone, they're going to pick it up. But as long as you're always sincere in the types of questions you ask and you spend a few minutes in the rapport building stage, which we haven't talked about how to build rapport, it's just not going to happen. So basically one of the ways you build rapport is you try to go up, as our friend Brian uses the word in physics, superordinate identities. You try to find commonalities that you have with people instead of what we currently try to do is constantly break people down on the basis of race or sexual orientation, really irrelevant things. And when you can build commonalities with people and change some of the words you use, like, you know, how could we find this out? Or so you use collaborative words. It's amazing. People
right,
just totally open up.
Right. You say, you don't say, you believe this, why? You say, we all want to figure out the right number so we can solve this problem.
Yeah.
Help me get to the same confidence level as you. I'm excited to learn or something like that.
Help me get there. Show me what you got because I'm genuinely curious. Help me get there. And so, almost everybody, when you ask them for help, will give it to you.
So this, I like, there's so many techniques that you write about that I like. I mean, there's, I don't know how the number of techniques, I think it's like over 20 techniques in here.
36. Thank you for reading it so carefully. I appreciate that.
Oh, no problem. Okay. The let your friends be wrong. I really like that. And I really liked, that was in the same chapter about the use the we instead of the you, but let friends be wrong. I like that. It reminds me of something actually I once heard a long time ago in couples therapy, which is basically let your wife say the last word in an argument.
Right. Right. So, okay. So let's talk about let friends be wrong. My co-author of the book, James Lindsay, thinks that this is the most important thing in the whole book. I disagree with that profoundly, but I understand why he believes that given our current cultural moment. You don't have to believe everything someone else believes, and they don't have to believe everything you believe to have friends, to be your friend. If that were the case, not only would you have a very boring life, but you'd have literally no friends. So what difference does it make if, now, there are definite deal breakers. You know, if someone's a genocidal maniac, that's one thing. But there are definite deal breakers that almost never will you encounter. But the problem is that the threshold for being offended is so low. And the threshold for wanting to kind of wall ourselves up against bad ideas. I mean, I've lost friends over the last few years because of my activities that it's been extremely painful to me.
Me as well. It really is painful. Like it's in my mind almost every single day. And you know, some days I avoid it, but most I don't.
And have you tried to reach back out to them?
Yeah. And in some cases that's worked. And in some cases, you know, just silence.
Can I plumb that for a minute? Can I ask you questions
sure.
about that?
Yeah.
So what was the thing that caused you to lose the friendship?
Okay. And in 2012, I think, or 2013, I wrote an article on July 4th that said no war, or it was actually on Memorial Day. I said no war has ever been justified. And meaning, you know, in general, I'm against any military activity that might involve killing civilians. And of course, a lot of veterans were upset, but I was trying to say, I'm not upset at veterans. I'm upset at the leaders who send children to shoot children.
Right.
And people would say, well, the Revolutionary War, and I would just dispute everything. And and there were some things I just didn't know. Like I really don't know enough about wars and history to say it. And I admitted that, but I lost a friend because he thought it meant that I approved of slavery, because through implication, I think I must think that the Civil War was not justified, which must mean forced slavery, which is obviously not true.
Yeah.
And he stopped talking to me for about 8 years. We only just reconnected last year, and we were best friends.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry that happened. I know firsthand how painful that is. So let's break that down, if you mind. So I think that the mistaken way to think about that is the word you use is dispute. Like, they say something and you dispute that. All that's going to do is that's going to drive them a deeper wedge between you, and they're just going to think you're a dick. Right.
Yeah.
So the better way to put it, maybe think about this framing. This is the framing I personally would use, and I'm not saying you should use it, but I would say, if you believe this, of course, I would say there's no war in which I would ever send my children to. And if I wouldn't send my children to it, I don't think it's justified for me to vote to send someone else's children to it.
That's a great response. And I did want to ask you this after, you know, you talk about a lot of your conversations and a lot of your painful conversations in the book. It occurs to me that you're very intelligent. And coming
I'm overrated.
I'm
overrated, bro.
No, but coming up with what you just said, that's not a technique. That's an intelligent response. And I wish I had thought of that, so I could have all the techniques in your book, and I still won't have that response.
Yeah, but that's respectfully, that's just not true. And the reason it's not true is because it just there is no special brain cell for conversation. There's no like neurological connector for that. It's just like literally anything. It's like jujitsu. I do jujitsu, and I was just the guy I was talking about last night. I was hanging out with John Frankel. Who's a renowned jiu-jitsu expert, but it's just like anything else. It's just a technique. That's all it is.
Right. But like my version of that, here's what I think I did say is I said, look, I don't know enough about history. I'm happy to read
that's a
any
good
books,
response,
but I just feel like, I don't like, you know, all the civilians who die mindlessly in any of these wars. So I don't know enough about the Civil War, but I'm assuming there's some way in which it's not justified.
Yeah. Okay. So in that was
and obviously I'm against slavery.
Okay. So that's a good response. So here's the other thing. Often when people respond to you, they may not be responding to you on the basis of the response you gave in terms of its, in philosophy, we say epistemic adequacy in terms of whether or not it's a good response, but from their own personal shit inside them. Let me give you an example. So a few years ago, I was teaching at nights, and literally I would do this all day. This is all I would do all day long. And then I pulled up in a gas station, and a woman came up to me who was on some kind of drug, and she had pus sores on her face. And
did you kiss her?
No, but she did come up to the car and she said, can I have a ride? I need a ride. And I have Crohn's disease, so I have this huge scar on my stomach. And I lifted up my shirt and I said, I would give you a ride, but the last time I gave a woman a ride home, my wife stabbed me. And she looked at my stomach and she's like, oh, okay. But the point
see,
is,
that's a good intelligent response.
Well, yeah, but if you do this, it's this again, this is, it's like jujitsu. It's if you do it enough, you get good at it. Like you don't need, if you care about this and you follow the template in the book, you will be excellent in no time. So that's the other thing. So I watched this, I started this thing called Street Epistemology from my first book, A Manual for Creating Atheists. And somebody popularized it named Anthony Magnabosco. And you can see his stuff on YouTube. He's phenomenal.
Oh, and you have one of his conversations in here about specifically Noah's Ark. He's the one arguing about Noah's Ark, right?
Yeah, I mean, we are, well, not arguing, but conducting an epistemological intervention, like asking people how they know that, figuring out their beliefs. And you can watch his stuff at YouTube, Anthony Magnabosco, Magnabosco. But one of the things that is interesting, why did I start talking about that? I totally spaced why I started talking about that.
You were talking about the woman who came up to your car and how it's like a muscle.
Oh, yes. Okay, so here's the thing, because you asked, you have to be intelligent to give that response. Not really, because since that book came out in, what, 2012 or 13, his videos came out, Reed Neiswander. Now there's like thousands of people all around the world doing this. And every once in a while, I watch a bunch of these videos and I'm thinking to myself, holy shit, these people are like, they are just as good at this as I am. And I do this all the time. And so what they did is that they just stood on the shoulders of giants and they just got, everybody just got better. And the thing about this is the learning curve is not that steep. But what you do is, here's what I would do. The book is written in sequential order. I say repeatedly, don't just jump to the latter chapter. Start like it's fundamentals, beginners, intermediate, advanced, expert, master, something like that. So start and work yourself up. And if you do this just a little bit every day, and maybe watch some videos that come out with it. I actually put videos of, I've set up a booth in the table when I was in LA. People have impossible conversations with me. And I put out the bad videos too. They're mostly bad videos where I make mistakes. That's when people learn the most from that, right? When they see me make mistakes and other people make mistakes, say, oh, Boghossian did this, maybe we should do this. But honestly, I'm telling you, there's nothing particularly special about me or this. It's just sticking to the template and doing it.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Even though you just said don't skip, and I agree with that because there's a lot of good advice in the early chapters, I do want to skip.
Let's do it.
In the advanced skills, you talk about vaccine deniers, and you say first, do no harm. And the reason I bookmarked that is one time I did have a conversation about vaccines that got really out of control. It started out as a Facebook thread on my personal page and ended up with thousands of comments. And I was neck deep commenting until a friend of mine finally called me and said, shut down the computer. You need to remove yourself from Facebook. And then I was talking to another person who writes about conspiracy theories. And he was telling me that basically people believe something, whether it's anti-vax or, you know, belief in huge conspiracy theories, where people believe something if some large institution they feel has betrayed them at some point in their life, and then they don't trust any institution after that.
Yeah.
And so that's often a source of these impossible conversations. Like, how do you deal with that when they're just never going to change?
That is a great question. It's a great question given the particular context of our age, where I've written about the fact that I think we're in a legitimacy crisis right now. I think there's a large-scale crisis of trust in our public institutions, in our judiciary, certainly in our university systems, the ACLU, the SPLC, the police to a certain extent among a certain particular elements of society. So it's really difficult because usually we would have ways, you know, people we could go to, trusted sources we could go to. You know, when I grew up, I'm 54, almost 55, we had Dan Rather, CBS, Tom Brokaw, we had ABC, CBS, NBC. And those were trusted. We trusted those, but we don't really have that anymore. We have highly politicized, fractured news, which acts more as a media echo chamber to push a particular narrative. So operating within that paradigm is so difficult. And that's why I would argue that it's actually more important to stick to how people know things and where they get their information from. And one of the best techniques that I use, and the older I get, if there were such a thing as a unified field theory of rationality, I would think that this would be a constitutive element of that. It's called defeasibility, but my publisher wouldn't let me put that in there. They made me change it to disconfirmation. So disconfirmation is basically the idea, defeasibility is the word that they use in philosophy. Disconfirmation is the idea that how could a belief be false? Like, we do that in science all the time. We try to falsify scientific propositions. With disconfirmation, how could a moral belief be wrong? Like, oh, I think, you know, we should let in immigrants, or I think trans women, no trans women in boy sports, or I think, you know, nobody should own a gun, or everyone should own, whatever the claim, doesn't make any difference. You have to ask someone, under what conditions would you be willing to change your mind about that? Like, what would the world have to look like? What would you have to see? You know, what would you have to, oh, I hate Joe Biden. Okay, what would he have to do? And then someone usually tell you something crazy, like, you know, bomb Toronto or something, whatever. But once you know the disconfirmation criterion, you're good to go. Like, you can then navigate that conversation with so much ease.
And there, what if they say nothing, like that guy about Noah's Ark did?
Okay, so there are only four. So this is the other thing. There are only four things people can say to you. There are literally four things. I suppose someone could just start singing the alphabet, but there are only four responses that could hitch to that. One is the best one, which is the ideal. Oh, here's the disconfirmation criteria, and they just tell you that. The second one is they can say, oh, there is no, there is, I will not change my mind on this. Like abortion would be a common, I just won't change my mind. The response to that is, oh, that's really interesting. Again, do you see how I propped up the claimant, right? Mm-hmm. It's like Tyrion Lannister says in Game of Thrones, the only thing that matters is what came before the but, right? You always want to just encourage and push up. You never want to but someone, you want to and somebody. And I say, oh, that's interesting. So there's no condition, there's no information that would cause you to change your mind? No, nothing. Oh, that's interesting. So then the belief isn't formulated on the basis of evidence. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, I mean, to form a belief on the basis of evidence means, by definition, that there has to be some evidence that could come in that would cause you to change your mind. But if there's no evidence, then the belief isn't formed on the basis of evidence. It's formed on the basis of something else.
Okay, and so what if they say?
Okay, well, hold on. So that's two. Let me give you. Remember, I said four.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let me just run through the other two. So again, there's only so many things people can say to you. They say, "Here's the evidence." They say, "There is no evidence." They say, "Geez, I don't really know what the evidence would be." Those are, in my opinion, those are the most interesting conversations. But okay, and then they could give you a wildly implausible disconfirmation condition. Those are interesting. In religion, I used to get, when I asked people, under what conditions would you be willing to revise your beliefs about Jesus being the Son of God, people would, the stock answer that fundamentalists give is the bones of Christ. If you presented me with the bones of Christ, that would mean that Christ didn't rise to heaven. So you show me the bones of Christ and I'll stop believing. Now, they know that I cannot produce the bones of Christ. With all due respect, neither can you produce the bones of Christ. But no matter what category they fit in, again, it's a roadmap for the future questions you would ask.
I see. So, but again, if they say nothing, oh, but then you ask, you know, really, there's no evidence at all. And at some point they get confused because, like you said, people are more about the goal rather than what led to their belief.
All right. Hold on. Not confused, perplexed.
Right.
Now, the goal of that line of questioning is not to make people become perplexed, but perplexity is a consequence of the line of questioning.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, I'm sure people listening to this could think of so many conversations that they've had with their friends and neighbors that fit this category.
Yeah. Let me give you a quick example. So I published a paper about this. I used to teach critical thinking, and I don't know if you knew this or not, but this is true. This is testable. You can take an egg, as long as it's not one of those thin-shelled eggs, and you can drop it out a 2 or 3-story window. And as long as it drops onto grass, it won't break. Buckminster Fuller designed the geodesic dome after this. And so I would take an egg, and I would ask people if they thought it was going to break when I dropped it out the window, and they look at me like it's a fucking lunatic. And then I'd drop it and they wouldn't break and they would be perplexed. But my goal was not to make them perplexed. My goal was to show them that dropping an egg out of a window, as long as it doesn't drop on the concrete, is not going to break.
Yeah. Okay. So,
the perplexity is a consequence. It's not you're not trying to make them confused. In fact, it's quite the opposite. You're trying to help them understand what they believe and make it clear to themselves to see if it's justified.
But you're playing the role, and authentically, you're giving them the benefit of the doubt that they know what they're talking about so that they can answer these questions without feeling stupid.
Right, because ultimately, this is a selfish endeavor. And the selfishness is, if they know something that I don't know, I want to know it too. I just need to make sure it's vetted. That's why the other technique we give in the book is change your mind on the spot.
Yeah, so a lot of people don't do that, but I find it very effective when I do change my mind in the middle of conversation because people are surprised.
Yeah, surprised would be one way. Blown away would be another thing, especially if it's in real time. You'll just, people will be utterly blown away by that. And the more moral it is, the more blown away there will be that you changed your mind.
So there's one point in the book or a couple of points where you say, you know, give the other person some outs, like make sure they're not a fool by the end of the conversation.
Right. That's one of the golden rules in hostage negotiation. And it should be a golden rule of any conversation. We call it from the Harvard Negotiations Project, build a golden bridge. And a golden bridge is an opportunity for people to cross over and revise their beliefs. So here's the opposite of a golden bridge. You freaking moron. It took you long enough.
Yeah.
Right? No. And then people are going to invoke a defensive posture. You want to make sure that nobody ever has a defensive posture. That's key.
In practice, how would you do it? Like, let's say you're pro-life and you're having a conversation with someone who's pro-choice.
Yeah.
And you want to give even though you strongly believe in pro-life, like this is coming from your belief in God, it's your family's belief, it's your generations of belief. How would you let a pro-choice person have an out?
Well, I'd say something like, you know, this is a really difficult conversation. Oh, I want to just add one thing to that. Almost nobody will change, because you mentioned saving face, almost nobody will change their mind if they're with a friend or someone from their moral community, because that's why Mormons go to the doors in twos, right? That's why people don't change their mind. That's why when cult indoctrination and cult exiting, they grab them as one person and not a group of people, right? That's what keeps people in cults, and it helps remove people from cults. So an example of a saving face would be, and again, this is even more important to clean up if it's two people, but if you do this, it's always one-on-one is best, is, wow, you know, this is super, super complicated, like crazy complicated. And I know I thought exactly like you did until I had this information. I was like, oh, wow. Like I had this thing and I realized this. And then you tell them what you realized. So that's a way to build a golden bridge. They could, well, I won't feel stupid because he believed it too. So he'll be empathetic to me.
Oh, I love this. Use outsourcing to bring outside information into the conversation, which is basically, you've discussed that, but you're basically kind of outsourcing to the person, tell me what I should know to get your confidence level. So that's the outsourcing technique.
Yeah, well, it's more than that as well. I mean, we talk about, there are lots of things that you can do, and it depends on the intelligence of the person with whom you're speaking. So if it's a complicated thing, like, you know, healthcare or socialized mess, something complicated, you say, oh, well, give me the names of three people you consider to be experts on the other side, and what are their arguments? Most people won't know three. If they do know three, then that's really interesting, that you can get a nice lesson. And then you can say something like, well, that's interesting, because, and so you would not say, well, if you don't know three experts three experts who hold different beliefs than you, then it's unclear that you can even know what you're talking about, because that will invoke a defensive posture. They won't revise their beliefs. But you could say, well, you know, I'm thinking about myself, and I'm thinking about if I personally don't know experts who disagree with me and what those arguments are, I hold my belief in less confidence. I'm less confident. And that gets back to the scale thing again. Is that reasonable of me? But you're not really asking them if it's reasonable of you, which seems reasonable to me that it's reasonable to you. You're asking them if it's reasonable to them, right? So in other words, if they don't know it, shouldn't they hold their beliefs with less confidence? I mean, look, dude, doesn't it bother you that people walk around cocksure of the stuff they believe in? That everybody has a grossly overestimated confidence in their beliefs.
No, but and it's true. And the fact that they can't validate those beliefs bothers me even more, as I'm sure it does you. That's why you wrote this book. Like, I was having how would you deal with this? Like, I was having a conversation with somebody about a particular election, not the most common election that we're thinking of. But I said, okay, you hate this one candidate so much. Tell me three laws that he's passed or three things he's done in office that were bad. Because he was just going on and on, trashing this candidate. And he couldn't give me one. And I said, if you give me one, I will completely change my vote. And he couldn't give me one at all, even though he was just trashing this person nonstop as a politician and as a leader.
So if that were a personal friend of mine, I would say to them, and I wouldn't do this for any other conversation unless it's a friend of mine, I would say, do you think it should bother you because you can't name a particular policy proposal that you feel so strongly? Do you think that there's a disjunct between your feelings and the evidence? And, you know, in the Republic, Plato talks about how reason should be on a chariot with the horses. You know, reason should always be the lead horse of the chariot, and desire, emotion, et cetera, behind that. And as long as reason's the first horse of the chariot, you're good to go.
But maybe it is reasonable to not know anything. Like, you could simply say, listen, I know a lot of people who know a lot more than me, and they all hate this person, so I'm just going along with them.
Yeah, but other people know people who know a lot more than them who look at an opposing candidate and have the same feelings. So how does an independent person adjudicate between those things? Because even in that case, it would seem to me that the confidence you have in this belief is not justified. But what's important for our relationship, I would think, you know, Aristotle talks about the highest form of friendship being between two virtuous people. I would think that you'd be this is a little alter casting from the book. You would be the type of person that would bother you. It would bother you that your beliefs are out of alignment with reality.
Yeah. So that makes sense. Again, I wish I had these techniques for like half the conversations I've had over the past 5 years, or well, probably 90%.
You're a young guy and you got him now.
No, young guy. I'm the same age as you.
Are you kidding me?
I mean, you're a young guy then. So how stupid I am? I just accuse you of being old when I should have been. You're as young as me.
Are you 54?
53.
No shit. And a half. Awesome. Wow, you look awesome. What's just a lot of vegetables? I mean, you don't even have gray hair.
No, I have gray hair. Just for some reason with the sun in back of me. I don't know. People say that when I'm on Squadcast here but I have like about, when I look at the mirror, it's like 50% gray about.
Well, not what I've seen.
There's so many bookmarks here. Okay, you say this thing about don't shoot the messenger, or it's a well-known fact that people shoot the messenger, so right. Don't deliver a message.
Correct.
And you define what a message is, and I think I'm guilty of delivering messages often.
We all
like do. I'll rationally make an argument. I'll say for something, for instance, like, nobody should go to college. And I'll present a rational argument. And
I believe that as well.
Well, there you go. And you're a professor, so that's saying something. So, and unfortunately, I have kids going to college, so it ruins my argument a little bit. But I also I believe that my kids will need me more later, and I don't want them to hate me now. But that's another story. But I think I was the messenger, and I delivered a message. And no matter how rational it was, and no matter how much just math and finance knowledge and whatever I used, if people had the opposite view, i.e. if they had gone to college, so they have a cognitive bias to, you know, confirmation bias is what they're looking for, not an argument. I mean, what is a message? Define message.
A message is your personal truth that you give to somebody. Usually people speak in terms of conclusions.
Right. So if you're writing an article, and I'm writing an article where I have what I view as a rational opinion, I will present the arguments against me, because that's a good technique for writing, is present their arguments before they do and answer them. So I do all this, but I'm still delivering a message. And I might even have a story in it about my own experience.
A message in an article isn't a conversation.
I see.
And if you want people to be more receptive to that message that you're going to deliver, give the most charitable spin. Say, this is where they're right.
Yeah, I see. I think I've definitely been guilty of delivering messages in articles. And then people will comment, oh, you're just trying to be controversial. And I'm like, no, I have actually very few opinions. But so talk about Rappaport's rules, because I like this as well. And again, this is I feel like this is out of couples therapy, Rappaport's rules.
Yeah, what page you on there?
Well, you mentioned Rappaport's rules in a couple different sections. I think the first time it might have been
chapter five, I think. But
yeah, five advanced skills for contentious conversations.
Yeah, so I learned about Rappaport's rules from Dan Dennett's book, my friend Dan Dennett, Intuition Pumps. So Rappaport rules they're just fantastic. This is one of the few things we should actually read in the podcast. One is attempt to re-express your target's position so clearly, vividly, and fairly that your target says, thanks, I wish I thought of putting it that way.
And also it shows that you're listening to them.
Correct. And in hostage negotiations, people have written a whole book about the phrase, that's right. You're looking for that's right. So if someone says, let me just be clear about this. I just want to make sure I know what you mean. And then you restate their position and you get their go ahead. That's by far, in my opinion, the most important of Rappaport's rules. Second, you list agreement. Third, you mention what you learn. And fourth, only then do you have rebuttal or criticism. That's the Rappaport's rules.
And the rebuttal or criticism is still, you know, epistemological, as you might
Correct.
Say in the book, where you're asking questions, you know, well, what's your confidence level?
Correct.
What's the evidence? So it's always about questions. You read Paul Johnson's biography of Socrates?
No.
It was very good. That's how I learned about Socrates. Paul Johnson's the historian, is very, very good.
Yeah.
Right. And then I feel like ultimately a lot of these skills, you're getting more and more technical about how to apply them. Like the principles are the same.
Correct.
Which is listen, repeat back, don't be contentious, don't call someone a moron, and figure out kind of like more subtle ways to bring up your topic. Here's a difficult conversation I had. So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was on the podcast, and as you probably know, he says he's pro-vaccine, but his message is very much anti-vaccine. And I did not want to get into that topic with him on the podcast, but he got into it, and it was about a 20-minute just spiel about his stance on vaccines. And he's someone who lost his trust in institutions. He saw his uncle get shot. He saw his father get shot. He assumed it was by the FBI. And so after that, he was all conspiracies all the time. And and here's the thing, I don't know the information about vaccines. I don't know anything. So even though I'm kind of like pro-vaccine, I didn't know how to respond to him at all.
Yeah, and that's 100% fine too. So here's one of the things you could do. If it's a podcast, I mean, again, so these are different than conversations. The question is, what should you do in terms of a conversation? Here's what I would do if I were you. Michael Shermer from the Skeptic Society is one of my best friends. I can connect you to, and you can have him on.
Oh, yeah. I love his stuff. Yeah. He's great.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm more than happy to have. So someone can come on and they can give their opinion. It's an unlettered opinion. I don't think he has any particular skill set in vaccines. I don't really know anything about Mr. Kennedy, but you can offer somebody who actually does know about it on the other side an opportunity to speak with you and have your audience listen to that.
Yeah. I thought about doing that. That was a good idea. And, you know, I also like this idea that you have about kind of zoom out is the way I would put it, where you kind of say, okay, well, obviously we care about people. We equally care about people's health, and we want people to live longer, and we don't want people to get
right commonalities
diseases.
You just found commonalities. So, correct.
So I think that's very, very important. And, and I do like the idea of it when they give evidence of at least acknowledging what you didn't know and thanking them for that. So for instance, in Robert F. Right. Kennedy, in his conversation with me, he said something, which is that, you know, maybe one vaccine might be good here and there. He doesn't know, but when you have to take 37 and they never studied the interactions between them, it makes it confusing, the whole issue of vaccines. And I agreed with him on that. Like, that was something I didn't know, that they don't really test the interactions.
Wait a second. It's not something you didn't know. It's something you hadn't thought about.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
What's the distinction, though? Like, if I hadn't thought about it, I don't know it.
But knowing it assumes that there's something true about it. You don't know enough to know that it's not true.
Right. I see. Yeah. So maybe they do test the interaction. I just didn't know one way or the other.
Right. Yeah. I don't mean to be pedantic when I do that, but I think that the words we use are really important because they trap us in ways of thinking or not, you know? So I think it's when you said that, it was accurate, but not precise.
Right. So I think that's very important. So, and this is like your master techniques, the moral reframing, like bring it back to a moral stance. Cause you both, everybody assumes they're moral. So you're both
right.
There's some level, which you'll find where you're both the same. And starting from that, you could kind of build up knowledge or at least know what they think, and understand a little bit more about what you think.
Yeah, that's correct. And as Steven Pinker, the Harvard psychologist, says, people don't knowingly do wrong. Like, nobody gets up and like, you know, I'm a horrible person. I'm going to fuck over, you know, I'm going to genocide a bunch of people nobody gets up. Everybody thinks that they do something because they're good people.
Yeah. So, okay. Now, if your goal is actually to change their mind, the other question I have is, why would you want to change their mind? Like, why do you care?
Let's take a look at that. I don't think it's about changing someone's mind. I think it's about instilling doubt. I think it's about giving someone the gift of doubt. And I can think of very few circumstances where it's not a good thing to be more humble about what it is that you claim to know. Although I'm certainly can give you those exceptions if you want, but it's a really good thing for people to have their beliefs in alignment with reality. And it's a really good thing for people to be more humble about what it is that they claim to know. Because we live in a democracy. We all vote, right? We all participate in the society at some level.
I actually don't vote.
Oh, well, then you're subject to the votes of other people. In fact, I might even say you're held hostage to them. So we live in a society in which we have daily, even in a pandemic, we have interactions with other people who make laws. So it would be a really good thing if we formed, to the best of our abilities, we had accurate information coming in, which we do not. But again, if I could wave a wand and say some of the things I'd like, well, obviously I would like no disinformation or fake news or what have you. But when information comes in, we formulate our beliefs on the basis of that. We make our decisions on the basis of that, and then we act accordingly.
So I see. So a lot of this is really about creating a skeptic as opposed to creating a changed mind.
Yeah, it's about creating a person or help. No, it's not about creating. It's about helping people to live, to do Socrates' question. The unexamined life is not worth living. It's about helping people to live more thoughtful, examined lives.
And also, it seems like it's also a emotionally safer way for you to have conversations with people that you otherwise might be angry at.
Correct. Yeah, I want to piggyback off of two things. It's also a way for you to lead a more reflective and examined life. Right.
So right,
because ultimately this whole thing really is a selfish endeavor. But even beyond that, so what you just said before, repeat what you said because I really liked it.
It's a way for you to have an emotionally safer, like, you won't be angry all the time at these people.
And when you begin your conversation in wonder, thinking like, wow, why would someone believe that's really interesting? Like, why does someone believe that? Like, I genuinely want to know why someone believes that, and start asking questions about why people, how they came to that conclusion. That's a pretty remarkable and intimate interaction.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, Pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
Here's a question. What if people do have legit facts and evidence backing up their opinion, but you have a different set of legit facts? Like, you're giving value to different sets of facts. So, for instance, gun control laws.
Right.
People who think that everyone should have guns say it deters crime.
I just bought two guns today. another AR in hand and another Glock.
Right. So you probably think, like many do, that the reason there's not a lot of crime in Texas, say, is because everyone has a gun. You can't get away with it. But other people might say there's a reason there's a lot of crime elsewhere is because everyone has access to a gun.
Right.
And they're both right. They both have correct set of facts, but they're just using a different.
Isn't that awesome? You just got a lesson.
Yeah.
You just got a free lesson, and then it give you things to think about, maybe read about. It gives you stuff to ponder. Next time you have a conversation, it'll be easier for you because you would have already heard those arguments. It's a win-win. You lose nothing.
But I feel like, what if you want to press the point further? Like, let's say you're pro-gun control and you say, but what do you think of the fact that where there's free gun, where guns are everywhere and easy access to guns, that there's actually less crime? What does that mean to you? Could you push further?
You could. I mean, the first thought that came to my mind was Somalia. There's guns everywhere, easy access to guns, but I'm quite confident that the crime rate, well, maybe not the crime rate, but the general murder rate. Nigeria would be another place. Nigeria has the whole country is basically an organized crime syndicate. But yet when Nigerians come to this country, they exceed their one of the most successful groups of Americans, along with Cubans, et cetera. But so it's not clear to me that that's always the case. So in that example, what I did was, I took what you said and I thought of a counterexample. Can I think of an instance of a thing that would make that false? So it's a way of habituating yourself when someone says something. And again, this is nothing special about me. You just follow the template in the book and you'll be fine.
So in that case, you're disagreeing with yourself a little bit by bringing up the counterexample. Maybe you're saying in this discussion about gun control, maybe you're saying that there really is no stable set of evidence that could prove either opinion.
Or maybe you're saying like, wow, I was harboring a belief that was false. Good thing I ran into this person, had a conversation with them. Now I won't have to believe something that's not true.
Right, right. And so what are some other difficult conversations that you've had? I've been telling my difficult conversations. What are difficult conversations you've had?
That's a really good question. Emotional relationship things are somewhat different because you're bringing so much history. Conversations with kids could be difficult. I find the most difficult conversations with people who are rooted in this new moral orthodoxy that has come up, in which they believe that race or gender or skin color determines your access to truth.
Let me question that because
sure,
you know, and this your co-author James Lindsay had an excellent book,
Cynical Theories.
Yeah, Cynical Theories, where he discusses a lot of this, and you know, if someone is a female black lesbian,
yes,
then there's civil rights, but then there's intersectionalism,
right,
where there could be civil rights to black people, like, oh, you can't have separate this or separate that.
Right.
But that still doesn't get to the heart of the problem when you have an intersection of minorities and you go for like the lowest in some hierarchy. There's the person who's the most, there's the intersection
right,
that's the most oppressed and they're allowed the loudest voice. And so that's the difference between thinking about equality as opposed to thinking about intersectionalism. And those are very hard discussions. Like, correct. People are very firm on those things. And he wrote an excellent book about this. And
should be required reading if people haven't read it. With Helen Pluckrose was the first author of Cynical Theories. Phenomenal book.
And so again, like, sometimes you do want to change people's minds and you do want to point out. So, okay, you were saying, you've had discussions with this new moral orthodoxy, and I could see either points. Like, maybe someone who is a black male might not understand the problems of a black lesbian. And so do you change the laws accordingly, or?
No, I want to go back to your comment again about changing minds. It's really not about, it really isn't about changing minds. I don't know. I actually do know some techniques to change people's minds. I didn't put them in the book because they're so unethical. One we put in was altar casting. We called it ethically murky. But the book isn't about changing anybody's mind. The book is about increasing someone's on the scale of confidence. It's about decreasing their confidence levels. It's about giving them, instilling doubt, helping them become more doubtful about what they believe. And so back to the intersectionality thing. Yeah, sure. There are experiences of people to it, like a black trans lesbian in a wheelchair. I don't have those. I was trying to think of another, someone who detransitioned. I was trying to think of another oppression variable. It's my friend.
And they're an astronaut.
Yeah, they're an astronaut. Well, that's not an oppression variable. So my friend Gavin.
Why? You have to put them in a room. You have to put them in, you lock them in a room floating in space. That doesn't sound, right. Well, that sounds okay. Pretty oppressive.
Right. Yeah, that's especially if it was against their will. So the prerequisite for any, so even let's take a step back. It depends on you talk about this in chapter two, what's your goal in the conversation? You should really try to clarify that up front. And you can change that as you go along. But often the goal is not to, is it to just kill time? Is it to impress someone? Is to, you like a girl or a guy or she likes you? Or, in classes, I found that people don't ask a question because they want to know the answer. They'll ask a question because they want you to think they're paying attention, or they're up with what's going on, or how smart they are. So you have to figure out what you want out of that conversation. And once you get that, you can work backward. And so one of the things that's difficult about those conversations about critical race theory, intersectionality, is that they start from points of view that are fundamental departures from the norms of rationality. And when you do that, you're dealing with an individual who does not participate in either civil discourse, norms of civil discourse, or kind of rules of logic that have traditionally applied from the pre-Socratics up to the present day.
Right. So, let's say this is happening on social media. This is one of the reasons why you can't argue with social media. So you say don't have important conversations on social media, which is where most of these conversations take place.
We talk about knowing the platform that's important. People often post on social media not because they want their views rebutted, but because they want them confirmed. So know why, like when you said your friend called you because you were going nuts on Facebook, like what is your goal with that? Was it to change people's minds? Was it to let people know how smart, like once you figure out your goal.
Yeah. My goal was not to prove how smart I was. My goal was to prove how stupid they were.
Yeah. Okay. So if you want to do that, you're already talking about, I'm not sure about the validity of the goal or the meritoriousness of it, but let's say that is your goal and you want to know how to proceed. That's all the more important to not deliver a message.
Yeah.
Anytime you deliver a message in that, it's going to backfire and make you look like you're stupid. Plus the other thing is that one more thing on that, let's say that they are really stupid and that you're engaging them. What kind of a person engages with stupid people?
I think you're quoting Obi-Wan Kenobi right there.
Oh, am I? I don't know. I'm not a Star Wars fan, but
who's more the fool or the fool who follows him? You could say who's more the fool or the fool who argues with him.
Oh, the fool. Right, right. So probably not a good use of time. And you strike me as a smart guy. So
here's my problem though, is that maybe once every 2 years, I'll have an opinion and I'll write an article about it, and I won't think much about it, but it'll stir some controversy. Like a lot of people won't like that, and I get a lot of heat on social media. And like you say, an article is not a conversation, but then suddenly a million people want to have a conversation with me about it. Then what do you do? And, okay. And by the way, so this happens a lot. Like Jordan Peterson, this happens too, even much more than me.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so this is something that I find particularly interesting. So in order to help us keep our beliefs tethered to reality, we need feedback about what we believe. We need to hear the best arguments against it. You know, when I was talking to the sound engineer, Jay, before we went on, he said, you're a very hated man. And I had to really chuckle about that. I'm called a Nazi 10 times before breakfast in the morning or some kind of heinous thing because of a position I've taken. And so you have to kind of figure out whose voice is not worth listening to. And the answer to that is, if by definition most people are average in something, then by definition they're not worth listening to. So, like, if I just to keep it on people's names, we mentioned, like, so if I wrote something and Shermer calls me or Richard Dawkins calls me or you know, Peterson, I've become friendly with, someone calls me or my friend Gad Saad calls me and they said, whoa, Boghossian, that means something, because I respect them. They have an intellectual gravitas, et cetera. But if a random, 6969 retard or whatever on the internet, you know, the username comes and they start criticizing me about something, why should I listen to them? What substantive contribution do they have? Domain specific expertise? They're like an anonymous guy with a vulgar Twitter handle. Like, why should I listen to them?
Right. So let's say there's three types of people who argue with you on Twitter. There's the trolls and random people who you don't care about. But then there might be the experts who they don't know you, but you do care about their opinion. And then I find the most painful category is the people who do know you and they're addressing you like in the third person, like, oh, I know him. He's right. Wrong all the time or whatever. How do you personally deal with that?
Well, two things. So, you know, when we wrote this book, I sent the last chapter, which is based on John Haidt's work, to John Haidt. And I said, how is this? He said, yeah, it's great. Works really well. At this point, I almost listen to nobody anymore because I have no mechanism to weed out the lunatics from the non-lunatics. You know, and the thing is, when we did the grievance study stuff in 2018, I just got hit piece after hit piece after hit piece. I mean, it's at one point, it was like they were coming out daily. And at first I started, you know, I wrote to Salon, I emailed Salon, I called Salon, Slate, I wrote to them, called them. I called all these, can I come on? Can I have a plug? Can I rebut these? Nothing, not one. So, you know, and my colleagues at work who have a pathological hatred and disdain for me, they're just opinion just doesn't matter. It's totally irrelevant. Why should I listen to them? Who cares about? I couldn't possibly care. What substantive accomplishments do they have? Now, there are rules of the game that we play by. All right. So there are certain, like the coin of a realm of the realm in academic publishing is my friend Bruce Gilley is doing this now. He wrote the case for just spoke to Bruce this morning. He's the guy who wrote the case for colonialism at the Third World Quarterly. And the journal received credible death threats. They wanted to take his PhD. They wanted his job. They had a petition circulating about him. I tell Bruce all the time, he's the second most hated man at Portland State University. And so what they should have done in that situation, there's no need for any of that name calling, invectives, or anything. What they should have done is say, you know what? Bruce Gilley is wrong. I'm going to humiliate him in the public square or his arguments. And they should have rebutted his arguments. But they did not do that in Third World Quarterly. They did that in other journals. And then Bruce wrote a response to that. That's how we participate in that's how civil societies advance the knowledge base. That's also why I said there's a legitimation crisis, because we have a lack of trust in our institutions. So now if someone makes an argument you find odious, you have a mob come after them and threaten to take away their PhD as opposed to doing the intellectual work to engage their arguments. But how I...
Right,
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, you go.
No, well, how do you personally deal with that?
Yeah, okay. Did you see what I did right there in our interaction?
Yeah, you said, and this was in the book, you said, you go.
Yeah.
And then I said, I started to say, you go, and then, you know, you go. And I know that the exact conversation happens in the book.
There you go. That's one thing people can take away from this. If you speak at the same time, you say, go, no, you go. Almost everyone will go, but you told me to go because you read the book, so now I'm going to go. So I think I just wanted to linger on that because I think that that's, again, something people can use. It's like when you walk into a door at the same time, you bump into each other, you should step back and just let the person pass through. The way that you deal with that is it depends what your goal is. Like, what's your goal for engagement? At this point, I almost engage. I went around the world repeatedly and I had talks in front of actual people, not people from the audience. You can see these. I don't even know how many of these are on YouTube at this point. And I would always say in the talk, always, if you disagree with me, you go to the front of the line. And I want to hear from you first. And
that's good.
I take those and I would urge other people to do this. I don't want an echo chamber. I want a challenge. That's the only way that I can make sure that that I can have justified confidence in what I believe. Oh, that's the other thing that you said before. You used a phrase. You said confident. I can't remember, but the word should have been justified confidence. But anyway, I shouldn't cut. Jay, just cut that part out right there.
But okay, so let's say my goal is, my goals are mixed in that I have an opinion that I want to be able to express, and I usually research my opinions pretty thoroughly when it's sufficient enough to write them. Doesn't mean I can't be wrong, but I'll have more research than the average next person.
Right.
But so that's what my one goal is, to express an opinion freely and to convince people that my opinion's right. The other goal is I don't want to lose friends. And those goals don't match very well.
Okay. So I am going to suggest something to you. I don't know you very well. I think, how well do you know Brian, by the way?
Pretty well. I mean, we've had, you know, a couple dozen conversations. And,
oh, okay.
You know, we've known each other over the past year.
So I would feel confident saying this to Brian. I don't know you very well, but I'm going to suggest something that may be radical. I would suggest that let me rephrase that. I would question whether or not those friends are authentic friends to you.
That's what everyone says. Like, oh, if they're going to abandon you on just this, they weren't really friends to begin with. And that might be true, but I just have a hard time believing that.
Well, it's a testable hypothesis.
Right? Well, okay. How do you test if someone wasn't really a true friend to begin with?
Well, you just be genuine and authentic in your relationships and say what you mean.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. And if someone's like, I can't believe you believe that. Now, people take authenticity to mean a bunch of things that it doesn't mean. Like, if you're attracted to your friend's wife, you know, you don't say to her, I want to sodomize you with a cucumber, right? So you have to have some kind of being authentic doesn't mean just brain dumping every single vulgar impulse that you have, right? Every base desire. It means being honest with yourself and others and speaking in a forthright and clear way. The Greeks called that parrhesia, speaking truth in the face of danger. I would argue to you that if you began this immediately and you started weeding out your friends, you would know almost immediately who your friends were and who they weren't, and that the quality of your life personally would go up dramatically.
I believe that. I guess it's just the surprise factor when yet another person sort of reveals who they are as not being, you know, what I thought they were.
But isn't that only better for you that the sooner people reveal themselves to you as not your genuine friends, the better. So that's even more reason that you just should start immediately.
Yeah, no, you're right. That's absolutely right. I mean, my solution was to basically get off social media pretty much completely and to kind of hide a little bit, which that's worked as well. But that's not as good an answer as your answer.
Well, I don't know. I mean, what's your goal in I mean, is your goal to, is this how you make your money through the podcast?
No, but I like to do it because I do have very strong beliefs about many things. Not as many as like the full Democrat or Republican platform, but you know, a few things that are important to me about living a better, more peaceful life, which is important to me. And some of that actually involves not having opinions about some things. And some of it is about, you know, don't make a bad financial choice with college if you're feeling strapped or if your kids are feeling strapped. You know, so my goal is really to help people with these opinions. But when people disagree, particularly because of some cognitive bias they have, they really disagree. And that, I've lost friends over the college thing.
Right. And that's okay too if they disagree. But what I don't, I guess what I don't understand is why would that cause you to them to not be friends with you anymore?
I don't know. Like I'm thinking about it, and I'm sorry this is all about my losing friendships.
No, don't be sorry. It's important.
Like I wrote an article. I wrote several articles about, and even a book about why kids shouldn't go to college, and here are some alternatives that could be even more valuable in your life, and so on. And I had one set of friends who had went to a very good school, and they, you know, didn't agree with me. And maybe I became too much the messenger instead of, I mean, I bet if I had used your techniques, I probably would have still been friends with them. But then I noticed at one point, I don't know, that they had unfriended me. And
yeah, but that's the thing too. Do you really want to walk on eggshells around your friends?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And you're right, but it's hard to switch. You're making it seem like a light switch. Like, okay, I'm turning that friendship off. I'm turning it on. Like, because they're not a good friend.
No.
There's like a lingering light.
No, if I gave that impression or if I articulated myself unclearly, I apologize. No, it's not that. It's just that I have a friend, like Matt Thornton is a good friend of mine. He's my jiu-jitsu coach, and we play Dungeons and Dragons together. And he was the guy I went out with John Frankel the other night. And I have pretty substantive disagreements with him, and I feel that I can completely voice those, and that our friendship is never in danger because we disagree about some thing, like some stance. Go ahead. You have a thought.
I think that's, I will take your invitation to go ahead. I think that's the critical thing, is that when you don't feel like, no matter what you express, you don't feel like you're in danger with that friend. And maybe before I qualify someone as a friend, I should first have that feeling.
Yeah. So maybe they're a friendly.
Yeah.
So you're married.
Yeah.
To a woman.
Yes.
And, in your relationship, you need to be honest and authentic, and you need to not be able to feel like you're walking on eggshells, but you also have to be careful to a certain degree. It's a thread the needle thing, right? You have to give a little bit of thoughtfulness to how you articulate yourself to, you know, sometimes we have a tendency to become so comfortable, we just pour things out instead of thinking about someone's feelings. Again, I think some people think that being authentic means you can be an asshole because that's your true self.
Right. That's like the radical honesty version of authenticity.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's all interesting. And look, the techniques in this book are really going to change the way I have conversations with people. And by the way, if you enjoy debates, these are also great debating techniques.
Yeah.
I wonder if you've thought of this one technique, which has come up a lot for me in particularly in debates or intense conversations. It's a technique I call labeling, which is, let's say I'm arguing about voting. So the main reason I don't vote is I like to be really neutral. I have a podcast. I want to have Democrats and Republicans on my podcast. So I try to be neutral. And I think when you vote, it gives you a bias towards whichever party you vote for. And I don't want to have a bias. The other reason is I know my vote doesn't count because 150 million people vote. So it's easy for me to buy my neutrality without it really affecting the election in some sense. But I had a debate with someone who was very much, who basically thought it was very un-American to not vote. And at some point during the debate, and it was an official debate, like people were watching it. And at one point during the debate, he said, you know, in this election in particular, if you don't vote, then you're a racist, or you could be thought of as a racist. And so I have this technique I call labeling, which I said, look, are we debating racism? And which I'm happy to debate about, but that's a different topic. Or are we debating the 250-year-old institution of voting, which is a different topic? So I labeled his comment as not relevant to the conversation. It was a comment about racism as opposed to about voting.
Correct.
And I find that useful.
Yeah, it's really good. In the book, we also, from hostage negotiations, they call it emotional labeling. And you don't ever want to say, oh, I can see you're upset or I can see you're angry. You would say, that must be so frustrating. Mm. And even capturing it that in that word frustrating can be helpful. It's also a type of empathy, but you can capture it emotionally. Capture as if you want to say label. You can emotionally label things to help better guide you through that conversation. But again, the whole point of this is that you can have better relationships. You can clean up your belief life, or at least have somebody, have people to bounce it off. And if someone knows something you don't know, how freaking awesome for you, right? That you just, you get to not live in delusion any longer than you have to. I mean, it's really a win-win for everybody.
No, it's great. I mean, this one thing that's an idea that's related to this, the topics in your book, is the concept of steelmanning your argument.
Right.
So you should know your opinion or your stance so well that you could argue the opposite side better than they can.
Yes.
And I find that to be very useful as well.
Yeah, and that's the one thing I think that we're sorely lacking in almost all of the humanities today. People don't know. They look at the university as some kind of a great big Catholic catechism where you go in with questions and you have pre-recorded answers that you kind of regurgitate. And you have to know the other side of an argument in order to know, in order to be justified in the confidence you have for your own position.
Well, all this has been so interesting. Peter Boghossian, who you wrote this with James Lindsay, who's also one of my favorites from his Cynical Theories book, How to Have Impossible Conversations, a very practical guide. My guess is everyone listening to this, the couple hundred thousand people listening to this, I've all had many impossible conversations this past year about economics, politics,
right,
pandemics. I always find on social media that everybody suddenly brings out, I didn't even know that this local gym teacher has a PhD in epidemiology until I read his comments on Twitter. Mm. Everyone's an expert on, they're either a general or an expert on the royal family,
right,
or
right,
all of the above.
Right.
And, you know, I think this is really valuable advice because not necessarily to have a great conversation with somebody, but although that will be the result, but to also just feel better. It's better to not be agitated in the middle of a conversation.
Yeah, I think so. And so I hope that the book, you know, we, again, as my first book, we went right to paperback. So there's no hardcover. It's not about, you know, making the cash. I just want to move society in a better direction. And hopefully that will help.
I hope you do. And again, there's very practical techniques. These are techniques you can literally use like an hour after you read this book. I'm going to go talk to my wife right now and start an argument and then use these techniques.
Well, thank you.
To make everybody feel better.
Thank you. I'm innocent in that. Well, I appreciate you having me on. Thank you, James. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And Peter, next time you're on, let's find something to argue about, and then we could use your technique. We could both use your techniques.
Perfect.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It's a win-win.
Yeah. All right, Peter. Thanks so much. Right, I really appreciate you coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.